From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for January 17th, 2020. This coming Thursday, it's Glorioso's third annual Beer, Cheese, and Sausage event. Man, that sounds like Wisconsin's Triple Crown. Your Milwaukee Bucks are home Monday night with the Chicago Bulls, and this will warm you up. Pitchers and catchers report to spring training in 26 days. I'm sure we're all aware of the tragic fires in Australia. Well, to help out, a local Aussie brewery shipped 800 gallons of beer to a hotel. That's the unofficial headquarters for the firefighters. But wait, there's more. In order to ensure its safe arrival, the government dispatched the Aussie Navy to deliver the beer. That's one progressive government. Okay, here's some fun headlines from this past week. 67% of Americans can't find Iran on a map. I'm hoping they don't work at the Pentagon. A recent study by St. Louis University found that marijuana improves your sex life. Well, that should speed up legalization. And the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, or Harry and Meghan if you prefer, have been offered jobs at Burger King of Canada where they can wear paper crowns at work. Man, they can't catch a break. In the studio today, we have Kyle Tedding, Steve Giles, Paige Ratke, Joel Dreesang. And wrapping up the week, here's Bob Landis.
Thanks, Max. We had a few nickels this week. NASDAQ was up 2.3%, climbing 210 points to close today at 93.87. S&P 500 up 2% also, 64-point climb to close at 33.30. Dow Jones Industrial Average tacked on 523 points this week, a 1.8% advance. We closed at the bell this afternoon in New York with the Dow finishing the week at 29,347. Year-to-date numbers look really strong. NASDAQ up 4.7 just for a couple of weeks, folks. S&P up 3.1 and the Dow Jones up 2.9%. You know, Kyle, I'm not real superstitious, but if you look at the first couple of weeks of the year in an election year, markets finished positive for the year 82% of the time. Pretty good odds.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that so often we like to point to is the momentum that's taken place over the last, really the better part of the last year, and you add in what's been a good couple of weeks so far to start 2019, or 2020, forgive me. And certainly I think, you know, it sets itself up pretty nice for continued strong returns. Of course, the challenge is we're coming on the back of what's a little bit of an expensive valuation right now for the markets. And so I think, you know, urging caution there is important.
You know, Kyle, as you know, last year was because the multiples expanded from 15 to almost 19. Pretty hard to repeat that trick. You get to 20 times earnings. It's the equivalent to a 5% earnings yield. And that doesn't leave a lot of wiggle room for risk. So the markets tend to run out of gas when PEs get to 20. So the point of it all is that it's got to be dependent upon earnings. And I noticed just an hour ago that FactSet has now downgraded earnings estimates for the year, now down to 9.5%. So, I mean, you started talking north of 10 a month and a half ago. Numbers are coming down. Pretty unusual just the first two weeks of the year to see that number get skinnier. So the point of it all is, can't be multiple expansion at this level with the market overvalued. Got to come from earnings. So let's hope they stop revising lower their estimates for the year.
You know, Bob, I think you look at what we came off of in 2019, which was largely a flat year for earnings growth, and maybe some areas had earnings growth. But when you look broadly at the S&P 500, you know, no earnings growth there. And so then you fast forward to what we expect for 2020. You know, and as you mentioned, valuations, we're trading right now at almost 19 times 2020's earnings. And so that's certainly very close to that that 5% earnings yield that you talked about earlier. And so I think, you know, as you say, it's got to come from earnings. And the challenge is going to be where in the S&P, what sectors is it coming from? What companies is it coming from? And the good news is that for just about every sector out there, the year-over-year comparisons get easier because we didn't grow at all last year. And so just from a simply comparison perspective, that becomes a little easier. And then you add in that things are starting to look a little bit more favorable potentially for some of the smaller businesses, potentially for some of the manufacturers. You know, still not good news there yet, but some slowing of the bad news finally, and maybe we can see some earnings growth there that we weren't expecting.
Kyle, as you painfully remember, in the fourth quarter of 2018, the markets were struggling down over 19%. Two significant headwinds. One was additional Fed rate increases. They raised four times in 18. The one in December really took the market by surprise. And the other was struggling with the trade war. January of 2019, the Fed said, in so many words, all right, we're probably done raising rates. The next change in rates is going to be lower. So the street took that as good news. And then fast forward to, you know, the last couple of months, the Fed, as you know, in December said, we're not going to change rates for the year. It's very unusual to get that kind of clarity from the Fed for that length of time. And then the president just before the holidays said that they're going to reengage the Chinese after the election. And you know, the market thought about that for a couple of days and kind of went straight up. So the point simply is significant clarity on rates. It's usually when rates are going up that accidents happen. And we're basically just being told that, all right, you don't have to worry about that. And they're not going to need to worry about the trade war worsening now because they're not going to engage with the Chinese till after the election. Market's pretty much taken that as good news.
It absolutely has. And I think you look at a third piece here, and that is what's been a global slowdown and really, I think, exacerbated by the trade war, but certainly was on its way to starting to slow down before that. And, you know, maybe not quite any clarity on that one yet, but when you've got clarity on rates, when you've got clarity on the trade war itself, you know, again, it potentially gives some clarity for businesses to spend, potentially gives some clarity for the next leg in what has been a prolonged but slow recovery. And so, you know, I think many signs for caution, many reasons to pay attention to what's going on, but some potential optimism there just for the fact that we're not worried anymore about what more can happen. Now we're worried about, okay, how good can this get if it gets good?
Steve, what's your take on current events?
Yeah, you know, I would agree that anytime you have a conversation with respect to earnings, you have to include the interest rate component. With the current 10-year treasury at about 1.8 and that earnings yield on the S&P coming in north of 5, you've still got an earnings yield that is high enough to give the market some support. I do think it does. It doesn't mean that we can throw caution to the wind, but to look at those returns from last year and perhaps use this as maybe a rebalancing opportunity as we turn the corner into 2020, Bob.
Paige, as you know, over the last 10 years, U.S. stocks have tripled, Japanese stocks have doubled, European stocks are up about 64%. China and the emerging markets didn't make any money the last 10 years. PEs in the U.S., as we've now said several times, are roughly 19 times earnings. And Paige, as I'm sure you know, PEs in Europe and Asia are roughly 13. You know, that's a bargain. And the problem, of course, is that they're cheaper, a reason to have no earnings. What's your take on the picture overseas, and when might the inflection point be reached when earnings start heading north overseas?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of things at play there. Number one, you know, we talked a little bit about the trade deal with China, and as much as that's had an impact on U.S. companies, we have to remember that U.S. and China are two of the biggest economies in the world. So not only did that put a halt on things that we were doing here, but that put a halt on things that were going on in Europe and Asia as they tried to find more clarity and say, okay, do we need to rethink our supply chain? Do we need to start getting things from China versus the United States? As that starts to settle down, I think we might see that clarity lead to a little bit more investment, a little bit more spending on their side to help grow the earnings. You know, a big thing, like you said, in the United States, multiples are pretty much as expanded as they're going to get. In Europe, you're still seeing multiples pretty fairly valued. So like you were saying, with earnings, you know, in the United States, we need earnings to increase those prices. In Europe, really just some multiple expansion. So just some forward-looking expectations on how earnings might grow could see a pop in the near term for those international markets.
Pretty disappointing to see the phase one trade deal that the president signed with the Chinese the other day. You know, the last time the trade deal fell apart, it was because the Chinese originally agreed and then reneged on their promise to pass a law on China that would provide the enforcement mechanism for the trade agreement. And the agreement that the president just signed, just leaves it up to Chinese to enforce the provisions. So pretty gray area, pretty squishy in terms of enforcement. And, you know, most of us feel that there's nothing fair about trade with China and something's got to be done about it. And let's hope for, you know, an agreement in the future that actually can be enforced. Because otherwise, what good is the agreement? Paige, the other comment I want to make about, you know, our conversation here is just sheer demographics. You know, when you look at GDP here in the U.S., GDP universally is only two components, as you know, increase in the workforce and productivity growth. You know, the problem here in America is that the workforce is only supposed to grow 0.2% a year here moving forward. And with productivity, how many pens can you make an hour, climbing only 1.5%. You back into GDP at 1.7, 1.8, that's what everybody's forecasting. But where I'm going with this thought is, it's a whole lot different in Asia. You know, the average age is 19, right? 19, 20 years old, compared to the U.S. at 41, or Europe that's even older. And, you know, you've got economies over in Asia that you've got just enormous amount of people entering the workforce. So, you know, my point simply is, I think if we ever do resolve the trade issues with China, you know, the next leg here moving forward won't be American stocks. It'll clearly be overseas.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Bob. You know, especially if you look at the United States, you know, as you all know, the consumer make up about 70% of our economy. That's not the case right now in China and in Asia in general. Most of their economy actually comes from manufacturing or state-run business. So as that population starts to grow and as those young consumers start to come of age and start to become more of a consumer-based economy, you know, not only are we going to see the increase just from a greater population, but just it's shifting away from manufacturing and more towards spending.
The number is growing, though. I read not long ago that they think there's about 340 million people of the 1.3 billion in China that are in the middle class. So that's bigger than the U.S. population. So, you know, it's a pretty substantial market, you know, per capita income there is a fraction of what we have here, of course. But, you know, they are slowly growing, and you're right, that's the answer to their problems. Hey, Joel, time to bring you into the show. As they say, a plethora of economic indicators this week. Let's start with consumer price index, lower than expected.
Sure, yeah, we were talking about, you know, gaining greater clarity on interest rates. Well, one of the reasons that, you know, we shouldn't have to worry too much about the Fed changing its mind and fussing with the rates is inflation seems to be under control. We had numbers this week from the consumer price index, which is the broadest measure of inflation, and that showed that for the third month in a row, the core consumer price index was up 2.3% from the year before. That's a little faster than the average since the recession, but that's not all that fast. The producer price index was even lower than that. It was 1.5% inflation year to year, and that was as high as 2.8% a year ago. And then we had numbers today from the Fed itself on capacity utilization, and that showed that we're still below the long-term average, and we haven't been that at the long-term average since April of 2008. So the fact that the capacity utilization hasn't been getting high suggests that that's one less pressure on inflation coming up.
You know, speaking of inflation, Steve, yesterday morning I did a 401k presentation. There were about 75 people present for my talk. And then I broke out and did one-on-ones with a lot of people, and I was struck by how many younger people had recently bought a house for the first time. You know, that because of the nature of this business, they attract people typically in their 20s, 30s, maybe early 40s. And, you know, it's not an extensive analysis of the housing market here, but I was struck by how many people that I talked to had purchased their first home within the last 12 months. And the reason why I bring this up is, you know, after 10 years of prosperity here in the United States, It's hard for me to imagine how inflation is going to stay this low for this long, because you've got, you know, record number of people working, right? You got unemployment at 50-year lows. If you lose your job this afternoon, you'll have one by tonight. So people are feeling confident, and I think it's just a matter of time before we see upward pressure. I don't think we're going to go back ever to the days of the 70s when we saw double-digit inflation, but I don't think I'm sticking my neck out to say that it's probably going to be a little higher than 1.3 year over year, certainly by the end of the year, which could cause some upward pressure on interest rates and set off a chain of events, as you know, for wages.
Yeah, and inflation isn't necessarily a bad thing.
There's been
a huge stigma because of events like we saw in the 70s. But to your point about younger buyers for houses with such low interest rates, I think it is, for those individuals, affordable now. They can buy those homes. Part of why I think we might be seeing more of these younger generations buying into homes is they had to wait a while. A lot of them came out of school right in the financial crisis. The housing market had collapsed. Some of them were still living at home. They're paying off their home, or not their home debts. They're paying off their student loans. This is a generation also. This is the millennials and some Gen Zs that just wanted to wait until they were on their own 2 feet before they left home, before they got married, and before they committed to buying a house. And to bring this full circle, as you have that demographic now entering into home ownership, you might get some upward pressure on inflation, but to your point, it isn't necessarily a bad thing, and it might help the economy longer term.
Well, and Steve, I just want to point out on inflation, in addition to really not carrying the negative connotations I think that so many have carried with it, it's also a reminder that the Fed's going to allow inflation to get beyond 2% before they have to take action. And so, it's a somewhat complicated topic that we've heard discussed a few times now from various Fed governors, but this idea of symmetric inflation targets, not asymmetric, meaning we have to allow inflation to move beyond 2 for a while to get the average back to 2 because it was below 2 for so long. And so, kind of a complicated way of saying the Fed could very well let inflation run at 2.3 or 2.4 or 2.5% before they really feel the need to say, okay, now we've got to raise rates again. Now we've got to pull those strings in a little tighter because, ultimately we're making up for those years of low inflation that we had before.
Changing subjects here, Kyle, as you know, growth stocks have dominated the markets here for a number of years. In a presentation you gave at the Landis & Company Investment Seminars in September, you talked at length about what's driving a lot of these tech companies is really free, unfiltered access to data. And as they data mine and sell that data, they're just printing money. And the question, though, is, they drag Mark Zuckerberg in front of Congress every other month, slap him around, nothing ever happens. But it seems that the pendulum is swinging towards clamping down on some of these privacy issues, and perhaps we'll even get an internet someday where we pay and where we ask for information that's just not spammed to us left and right. But my question has to do with, with tech stocks dominating the market and their earnings driven by free access to data, it seems that that business plan can't continue indefinitely.
Yeah, I think we should all remember who is the consumer here and who's the one that's being consumed when we're talking about technology stocks. And, you look at somebody like Google and, you might go to Google and type in a search. You're not the consumer. They're taking that search information. They're packaging it off to people. They're selling your information to companies that want to advertise to you or to companies that want to know more about you. And so, I think what we've realized the past few years is that so many of the companies that have been highly valued are companies that historically we maybe wouldn't have thought of as tech companies, but which have entered that space because of the data they gather, because of the ways they connect to our lives. And so you've got, fitness bikes that now want to be connected fitness. It's not an exercise bike anymore. This is connected fitness. You've got essentially taxis that now want to be called ride sharing because they want to be a technology company. They want to get that valuation. And so I think as we progress from this free exchange of information where everyone's fine with being the thing that's consumed rather than being the consumer to wanting to take back the right to be the consumer, to want to wrap their arms around their own data and their own privacy and say, you know, I don't want to be advertised to in this way anymore. I don't want people to know this about me. You do enter an environment where, you know, maybe there's some new ways to make money, but it also means that some of those old ways become, I think, less valuable than what we thought in the past. And so I think it's going to be critically important to look at some of those technology stocks in our portfolios and say, is there going to be a change to this business model? And you look at some of the old guard technology companies, the ones that have a product to sell and that are selling it to businesses or selling it to individuals, whether it's software, whether it's, you know, a hard tech product. You know, I think those are the companies whose earnings are going to be a little bit more stable down the road. I think you look at some of the companies that are more data focused, though, and that's certainly going to be an area where, as we see changing laws, as we see changing social norms, you know, there may be some questions about what those valuations look like.
Kyle, I go to extreme lengths to guard my privacy. I'm a very private person. I'm not on social media. I don't want my privacy invaded and then disseminated and then used against me to sell me things. And I just wonder at what point does the collective consciousness sink in for others in the country that are just tired of having their privacy invaded. But it seems to me the way the winds are blowing is this could be the heyday, the peak now, of free unfiltered access for data for the tech companies. And it just seems to me the pendulum is going to ultimately swing. And, you know, for years we've talked about, you know, when will the core stocks and the value stocks look a little better? Well, maybe it's when Congress starts beating up the tech stocks for the privacy issue. Just something to pay attention to, you know, moving forward. Well, folks, that's the end of yet another Money Talk. We enjoyed doing the show. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.